The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
Just want to check the sound because my voice tends to... Can you hear in the back? Is that okay? Sounds okay. A little higher, a little. It's okay. Very happy to be here tonight, and happy to see so many people. I haven't been here on Mondays in a while, so one of the things that I often think about this practice, this path, is that we can't do it alone, you know, and so to come here and to sit with other people. It's such a wonderful thing. And the fact that you're here supports everybody else. I know sitting with other people has been quite an important part of my own practice, own path. And then this idea of something about we can't do it alone, and we can't... We don't just do it for ourselves, or something like that. I think for most of us, when we first come to meditation or come to Dharma practice, there's this sense of, by doing this practice, by learning this skill, my life will go better. And, you know, it's a very reasonable motivation. And then at some point, for many of us in the practice, something shifts. And it's not so much how can mindfulness make my life better, but how can I live in a way that expresses truth, that expresses awareness. Anyway, that's just a little thing I was thinking. There was an article in the New York Times a few weeks ago with the headline, The Muddled Meaning of Mindfulness. I don't know if anybody... saw that. It was one of the most emailed articles of the week. And so I try to muddle it a little bit more tonight. Sometimes we call this meditation mindfulness meditation or insight meditation. I think maybe the more precise label, if we were going to look at where this comes from, is we would call it satipatthana meditation. This is a Pali word, and the Satipatthana Sutta, the Satipatthana teaching, is where the instructions for this kind of meditation are explained in quite a lot of detail by the Buddha. So sati, the word sati, is usually translated as mindfulness. Although, that may not be, that's a good word. Some people think the word awareness might be a little bit closer. But what sati really means is the observing power of the mind. The knowing power of the mind. And patana, people aren't quite sure what that means either, but it's usually translated as the establishing or the foundation. So satipatthana is this close, careful, steadfast establishing of awareness on the object. But it's not only that. It's not only this presence or this awareness, this knowing directed to the present moment, but it's without the filter of greed, hatred, delusion, without the filter of wanting or not wanting. So this is our practice. This is the mindfulness practice. You know, there's a certain kind of awareness, alertness, clarity that a pickpocket has to have. You know, he's paying attention, looking, and very you know, watching in the present moment, very much in the present moment, and you know. But is that mindfulness? Is that mindfulness according to the Buddha? You know, by this definition, maybe it wouldn't be mindfulness. And so then this question comes up, what is the relationship of Satipatthana practice, mindfulness practice? You know, why are we doing it? What's the point? What's the relationship of this practice to our happiness, to our freedom? It's said that the purpose of practice, or sometimes talked about as the goal of this practice, is a kind of inner happiness you come to, an inner freedom that doesn't depend on the conditions of the world. The conditions of the world are constantly changing, you know, so they're impermanent. And because they are changing, they have the characteristic of being unsatisfactory. They're not capable of providing lasting happiness. So the Buddha went out and searched for some way of finding happiness or finding ease or finding freedom, taking into account the nature of how things are. So this is the freedom we're talking about, that it's a kind of independence from conditions. It's like usually, according to this definition, usually we're not free in the sense that our mind, our awareness is bound up, is caught, is hooked on something. It's entangled. Usually entangled in what we want and what we don't want. So there's a famous teaching where a monk asks the Buddha, "Is it inside is a tangle, outside is a tangle? Who can untangle the tangle?" You know. So something about this practice is pointing to disentangling ourselves, disentangling the mind or awareness from these kind of capricious winds of, you know, of our life. And so one question, just, you know, that I feel is important to hold, or is that, you know, might be an interesting question to explore, is whenever anyone, doing any kind of Dharma practice, or any teacher gives an instruction, or you read something, it's like, what is the relationship of this instruction, of this practice, to this goal, to this point of disentangling, untangling ourselves, of freeing the mind in some way, of bringing this inner freedom, inner happiness. So the practice points to this possibility of being free from our clinging, free from our entanglements. And then the question becomes, how do we do that? How do we do that? And it turns out that it's actually quite difficult, maybe almost impossible, to approach this kind of non-clinging directly in a way that is much easier, that's much more practical and effective and fruitful, is instead of going for non-clinging, is to look at our clinging itself, to study, to get familiar with the ways that we're entangled, the ways that we're holding on. And so if only there were some moment, some movement of mind where this whole process gets started. It turns out that there is, or the suggestion is that there is, that actually if we trace back our suffering, our clinging, how the mind gets caught up in wanting, in fear and frustration and desire and irritation and all these things, it comes back to the moment of when we experience pleasant and unpleasant in the mind. It's this very simple, this very basic experience of pleasant and unpleasant, which conditions all the kind of clinging that comes after it. So this is, in a way, this is like the pivotal point, the key point. One of the great commentators in our tradition, who is a monk, a German-born monk named Jnanapanika, he calls this moment, or this experience of pleasant and unpleasant, he calls it the weakest link in the chain of suffering. So this is called Vedana in Pali. So according to this teaching of Vedana, every moment of experience, every conscious moment of experience, either has the nature, it has the characteristic of being experienced, being known as pleasant or unpleasant. Or, there's a third option, which is neither pleasant or unpleasant. Sometimes, usually that's translated as neutral. So each moment of our experience, is either registered, is experienced as pleasant or unpleasant or neutral. The word Vedana has the meaning of to know and also to feel. So it's kind of at the intersection of feeling and knowing. I like to think of it as It's how, it's in the how we experience something. Usually, Vedana is translated as feeling. So you may hear that mindfulness of feeling. You know, in the Satipatthana Sutta, the Buddha taught about the four foundations of mindfulness, four areas that we can establish mindfulness. The first being the body. The second is Vedana, feeling. And then Citta, which is mind, or you know, states of consciousness. And the fourth is dhammas, objects of mind, mental experiences. So this Vedana, translated as feeling, is a little bit, the word feeling is not so good, actually, because feeling in English tends to imply emotion. And Vedana is something before emotion. It's just the bare sensation that's registered as pleasant or unpleasant or neither. So often we translate Vedana as the feeling tone of experience. So it's just kind of like, you know, every moment there's this, I mean, there's many things happening, coming in through the sense doors, the five sense doors in the mind. But there's also this flavor, this texture of experience, you know, which is either pleasant or unpleasant, you know, or neutral. And the reason this is such an important frame of practice, this important way of knowing, is that it's our reaction to the pleasant or the unpleasant, which is what conditions are clinging, what conditions are craving. So if I'm at a point where I'm really I'm really angry, actually, because there are no more chocolate chip cookies left, you know, and someone, you know, I just got through the lunch line and I'm, you know, and someone, and there's no more chocolate cookies left. They say, well, why am I angry? How did I get so angry? And so this is, the suggestion here is that there's a way of tracing this emotion back to some basic experience of pleasant, unpleasant, you know. It may be that I was looking forward to having the cookie, and I was thinking about, you know, thinking about it, and saw other people with cookies, and what triggered all of this was the smell of the freshly baked cookies, you know, and I smelled it, and that smell, that was pleasant. The experience is pleasant, and then boom, 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 you know, all these things happen. So a pleasant experience is said to condition, to trigger enjoyment, desire, wanting. Whereas an unpleasant experience conditions aversion, irritation, you know, pushing away. And this neutral experience triggers a kind of confusion or boredom. You know, and so the idea is that all of our clinging has its roots in this very, very simple knowing of pleasant and unpleasant. And how we react to that, how we get caught by that. And just to say, when I first heard this teaching, it wasn't that interesting to me. I didn't It was like, okay, you know, pleasant, unpleasant. And in fact, it seemed a little bit dry, or a little bit, there's something about it that's too, can sound a little almost reductionistic, you know, of like, is that all a human being is? Is just these moths, you know, going to the light, or this kind of pigeons going for a little bit of something that tastes good. And after a number of years of meditating, I can say, yes, that is it. I don't think that. I think it's one way of looking at our experience. And, you know, all meditation is, all mindfulness is a way of looking, a way of seeing our experience that can release us, that can bring freedom. So this is one tool. It's one tool that, you know, it's so simple in a way. So it's like embarrassingly simple. And I was thinking about it, and I said, like, I don't know if I can talk for an hour or whatever it is, 45 minutes about it's pleasant or unpleasant. You know, I mean, it's so simple, but it's so fundamental. I notice this more and more now that I have children. And, you know, I don't know if you have children or if you're around babies or, you know, and it's like, you know, we don't teach babies to like what's pleasant and to not want what's unpleasant. You know, it's so built in. It's so conditioned. It's like I have a three-year-old, two daughters, a three-year-old and a one-year-old. And especially, I mean, the three-year-old is a little more sophisticated now, but when our one-year-old is really upset and really crying, if I can just find something that's delicious and, like, pop it in her mouth, you know, immediately she goes from being extremely unhappy to being happy. You know, just like, oh, something's pleasant. And she's like, you know, the phrase comes into my mind, a heat-seeking missile. You know, she's kind of like this pleasure-seeking or pleasant-seeking missile. She just like will look around for something that's pleasant, that will give her some pleasure. You know, she'll look, this looks okay, this or this. She's just like, and so it's very interesting. And watching her, seeing that, it gave me more appreciation for how deep these roots are of pleasant and unpleasant. I see it in myself. You know, we want what's pleasant and we don't want what's unpleasant. And so what this teaching suggests is the possibility of seeing, of meeting, of stopping at the level of pleasant and unpleasant without this, without it triggering this clinging in the mind, triggering this kind of compulsion to want or not want. If you've been meditating for a while, I mean, you know, in some traditions, not so much in our tradition where we meditate with our eyes closed, but in some Buddhist traditions, like in Zen, where you sit with your eyes open, and the teacher is watching the students, you know, so the teacher is watching you meditate. And in this way, it's said that it's quite easy for the teacher to know where each student is at just by how they sit. You know, in the Zen tradition, there's quite a lot of emphasis that's placed on not moving during the meditation. And so, you know, so the request or the kind of the you know, it's a little more than a request because there's a stick if you move, is don't move. You know, when the bell rings, don't move. And then, you know, however you need to arrange your mind to make that happen, you know, is kind of how it goes. And you know, it's just like, we're so conditioned to just want to be comfortable. And when discomfort arises, it's almost automatic that we just, you know, scratch the itch or adjust our legs or whatever. And so, you know, so implicit in this, you know, not that I think there's any kind of an absolute value in not moving or in stillness. I mean, there's certainly a value in stillness. But by putting ourselves in the position where unpleasant experience will arise, we learn how to be with it. We learn how to work with it. We learn how to somehow not be in conflict with what's unpleasant, you know, and develop those qualities of patience and insight and wisdom into the nature of pleasant and unpleasant. Gill often says, you probably heard him say this at some point, if we're only free when things are pleasant, you know, maybe that's not really freedom. Maybe we're not really free. Maybe that, you know, there's something about this independence from pleasant and unpleasant. So I have a question for you. Do you think that the pleasant or unpleasant nature of the experience does that reside in the experience itself, in the object itself, or is that in us? You know, so is that objective or is it subjective? You know, so one example, we probably all as children tasted beer or wine or coffee and just go, ugh, you know, that is yucky. You know, why would anyone, you know, drink that? But then, you know, get older and you're just like, oh yeah, you know, these are tasty things. You know, anything, the sound of the bell might be experienced as a very pleasant sensation if we're sitting and our knees are aching and we're falling asleep or we're bored or we're frustrated. There's a ding, you know, great, finally. You know, so what about if we're, I don't know, you know, if we're taking an exam and we're scrambling to finish it and then, you know, ding, you know, time goes off, like, oh no. You know, I'm sure you can think of examples, you know, of something that's ordinarily pleasant, like, you know, a piece of chocolate cake, for example. Maybe one piece of cake is pleasant, but 5, 10, 20, you know, at some point that same taste will be experienced as unpleasant. You know, what I'm trying to point to is that there's a large area of this, you know, this realm of pleasant and unpleasant that is subjective, that resides in us. I think it's an interesting question. Can a situation or can something be inherently pleasant or inherently unpleasant? There's one teaching in the commentaries, I don't think it's in the suttas that the Buddha, you know, is said to have taught himself, but in the commentaries, which says that bodily sensations or feeling tones that come from the body are either pleasant or unpleasant, you know, have this inherent quality. You know, it's like touching a burning stove or stepping on a nail or something, pretty much by everyone is going to be experienced as unpleasant. Whereas from the other four senses, sight, smell, taste, sound, are said, at least according to this commentary, to be inherently neutral, neither pleasant nor unpleasant. And then we experience them as pleasant or unpleasant according to, you know, how we are, our conditioning. So it's something to explore. In any case, there's a vast, most of our experience falls into a lot of our experience falls into the realm of this subjectivity. So this vedana, this feeling tone of pleasant, unpleasant, or neutral, is said to be like the weather. The winds, sometimes they're dusty, they're strong, they're weak, they're hot, they're cold. Where I live in San Francisco, it gets really windy at night this time of year, and, you know, just the whole house is shaking. And so this is pointing to this impersonal quality to pleasant and unpleasant. It's so easy for us to identify with it and take it on as me or as mine, but it's impersonal. And you know, and they're impermanent, they're ephemeral, they're changing. These feelings of pleasant and unpleasant are compared to bubbles on the surface of the water that's just, you know, just moment to moment. And, you know, during the sitting, I was sitting and just practicing with pleasant and unpleasant, and I had this thought that we all know this. You know, there's something so intuitively familiar with this teaching, that just that, and I think that one of the it's one of the less popular mindfulness instructions, and I think one of the reasons is that there's something that's a little bit, it's slightly, I don't want to say depressing, but there's something of like just of when you just, if you really see moment to moment, it's like, and just noting it, it's like pleasant, pleasant, neutral, neutral, unpleasant, unpleasant, pleasant. You know, it's like there's this, I don't know how to explain this feeling I had, but it's almost like something, you know, but you try not to think about. You know, usually we're so pushed and pulled by these that this just this simple act of turning the mind toward pleasant and unpleasant and neutral is a little bit like facing the dragon or opening the basement door. And like, you know, we're so convinced by that if only we increase the number of pleasant experiences in our life, you know, then we'll be happy. And if we can just minimize the unpleasantness, if we can just, I mean, ideally zero it out, but if we can't, at least minimize it, then, you know, we'll be minimizing our unhappiness. And And so something about this teaching and being with this quality of our experience, it's a key, it's the key to becoming free of it. When we don't see, when we don't catch it at the root, then, you know, it's kind of like the horse has left the barn kind of thing. Just to take this concept of liberation down to this very nuts and bolts, you know, having the experience of being in a traffic jam or something, and, or, you know, then thinking, okay, I'm going to be late and this and that, and why is this person? And just stop, being able to stop and being able to just check in and say, this is unpleasant. This, you know, this experience right now is unpleasant. And it's like, oh, right, this is unpleasant. You know, so there's something, I'm just even in that this simplicity, there's something that can be very freeing with that. I can't believe it's almost 9 o'clock. I've got there's so much to say about this. You know, so I had heard this teaching of pleasant, unpleasant, and I go, oh, yeah. But what really grabbed me was when I was on a long retreat, and the teacher, who was Joseph Goldstein, in Massachusetts, he was talking about a time in his practice where he was really grappling with a lot of desire. A lot of lust, a lot of desire, a lot of fantasies in meditation. And then as he was just talking about how he was relating to it, how he's working with it, he said, you know, so came back again, and then I was noting pleasant, 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 pleasant. And I thought, oh, that's how you do it. Like, that's how you, you know, it's like, you know, having the exact same experience being a young person on the retreat and sitting there, but it had never occurred to me to see these daydreams, these fantasies, these desires, to see them as being in the moment pleasant, you know, or to see my difficulties, my frustration or anger or jealousy or, you know, whatever, as being unpleasant. There's something unpleasant in the moment of, you know, when that person came in and was very noisy and taking off the kind of Velcro one by, you know, sitting there listening to it. It's like, this is unpleasant. unpleasant. And, you know, so just briefly to talk about a few ways of working with this. You know, so the primary way is this very simple knowing of a clearly knowing the feeling when it arises as being pleasant or unpleasant or neither. You know, and there's something about tuning into this frequency of pleasant and unpleasant that helps us not to get caught up with the content. I mean, it's pretty straightforward to see the connection between pleasant and wanting and unpleasant and aversion, ill will. But sometimes it's like, wanting or desire or fantasizing comes up in the mind because there was actually an unpleasant sensation that we wanted to escape from. So when you're sitting and you're having a feeling of being, you know, there's a pain in the knee or something, it's like we just want to escape from that unpleasantness and replace it with something pleasant. You know, so it's just something to notice. what is my relationship to pleasant? What is my relationship to unpleasant? In working with this, what do you tend to notice? Do you tend to notice, is it easier to see unpleasantness? Is it easier to see what's pleasant? The neutral tends to be the most difficult to see. You know, and just to say that the incredible value for this in our everyday life, where we're so, you know, we're so pulled around by our emotions, by our reactions. And, you know, this is a way of just tracing it back, just turning, it's so simple. You know, and then as our practice unfolds, we can come to more ease, you know, just the more ease with, you know, the whether the external world is pleasant or unpleasant. So that's pointing to this freedom. And it's very interesting. In meditation, in deeper meditation, what's neutral can actually start to be experienced as pleasant, as more pleasant. And one of the instructions in meditation is pleasant experience is very important. And as pleasantness arises in meditation, sometimes, often, the instruction is to encourage that pleasantness, because that is what allows us to deepen concentration, to deepen that ability to be here. Because it's just, for the you know, simple thing, it's just easier to be with what's pleasant. So as we have pleasant feelings in the meditation, you know, is there a way that we can kind of somehow adjust the breath, make it more pleasant? And so the Buddha says, just to end with these, one who develops full detachment or non-attachment with regard to the three feelings of pleasant, unpleasant, and neutral, ends suffering here and now, breaks the chain of contact, feeling, to craving. So to see Vedana, to see this feeling tone as impermanent, as it fades away, as it ceases, this brings dispassion, this brings insight, this allows the letting go. So maybe that's enough for muddling the waters, even hopefully that, you know, is something to work with. So you know, so just as you sit here, as you walk out, whether what you notice is pleasant or unpleasant or neutral, to see it, to know it just where it is, to know it just as it is, this is the place where we find our freedom. So I wish you a pleasant or unpleasant or neutral evening. Yeah. Thank you. Thank you very much.